Accession number 17543, Reel 1.
Mr. Fenton, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Hull.
Which year was this?
The year was 1917, February, 25th of February, 1917.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Hull?
The whole of my informative life was in Hull. I started at a normal school, went on to the Boulevard Secondary School, and that was my education. And I worked in Hull until the outbreak of war.
How old were you when you left the Boulevard?
I'd be 16 years of age.
To do what?
I became a clerk in an estate agent's office, originally. But I had other jobs other than that as the years rolled by, you know.
What job were you doing when war was declared?
Selling air raid shelters.
Can you tell me more about it?
Well, it was for the corporation, actually. The best job I've ever had. They were queuing up in those days in Hull for air raid shelters. But there's a long story that goes with that, and I won't tell you any more about that. But that's what I did.
That would be interesting to our museum. What did the air raid shelters consist of?
Well, there were brick with concrete roofs. There were also the Anderson shelter, which was a corrugated sheeting which was covered with concrete. That was the normal one. And the concrete would be about 8 or 9 inches thick, something of that sort. I've spent many hours in those, I might say, when I used to come home on leave.
And who would buy one and who would buy the other?
Well, there was a certain number that were given by the corporation, and after that people who wanted them quickly and had the money were able to purchase them.
But, I mean, who bought the Anderson shelters and who bought the brick ones?
Well, the Anderson shelters normally went to the ratepayers of the city, you know, but the brick ones were built privately, and not always privately, but where people were prepared to buy. Because when I say there was a certain amount of panic, people didn't know what was going to happen and they wanted an air raid shelter, you know, and they were quite prepared to put their hand in their own pocket and pay for it.
So you mean the Anderson shelters were on the raids?
More or less. In certain cases they could be purchased, but generally speaking the brick with the concrete roofs were purchased.
And did all ratepayers get an Anderson shelter?
Well, of course, it depended how your property was located. If you hadn't got the space at the rear of your house, they then used to build big air raid, which I had nothing to do with. The corporation used to build them in the street or in places logistically which were the best place to put them. Like they had in London, I suppose, or other towns, you know.
And who was making the air raid shelters?
Oh, well, they were made by the corporation employees that were doing the Anderson shelters, and private enterprise was doing the brick shelters, mainly.
And which were best from the point of view of sheltering you from an air raid?
Well, they were both very good in their own way. I mean, nothing could save a direct hit. I mean, you know, but what you could hear, and speaking from experience, was we used to have gun batteries all placed in strategic parts around the city, and when the German aircraft came over, they'd open up and you could hear all the shrapnel hitting on the roofs of these air raid shelters, because the shell used to burst and the metal used to shower down. Very jagged they were. You didn't want to be anywhere near those.
Were you actually working for the Hull Corporation?
I was. I was in the engineers department.
So how did you go about selling them?
Well, as I say, if people came and used to, there was a big, shall we say, queue waiting for them. But if somebody said, look, you know, and I used to send them off to a private entrepreneur who used to do them for them, you see. Used to work in that manner. But there was only a certain number could be done, and it's very difficult to explain in this day and age just how people felt, you know. I mean, it was a You see, the big thing before, just before the war started, nobody knew what to expect. It was an unknown quantity, you know, completely. And you didn't know whether you were going to get blown up the next night, or we just didn't know, you know. And there was great apprehension by the public.
Were they expensive?
They were quite... well, those who had money didn't notice it, you know, I mean, but 50 years ago, and knowing what you could buy today, no, I suppose not, they weren't too expensive. They were within the reasonable pocket of anybody who, you know, had money. And some people built their own, by the way. They didn't wait, you know, they went ahead and built their own shelters. In many big gardens in Hull, they dug deep down and then did their own thing about covering it up, you know, things of that sort.
Somebody was telling me that the water table was too high.
Well, it was indeed, yes, you did get that trouble. But here again, you see, if you concreted the base, you could keep that out. But of course, with the corporation putting Anderson in, that was never done. You just got put into the earth, and this is where the water table, as you correctly say, was pretty high. But here again, the ones that my parents had, my father installed a water pump, you see, and when the water came in, he just used his hand lever pump and pumped it out. There was great ingenuity in those days, you know.
Why did you enjoy the job so much?
Well, I felt I was helping people, you know, after being in commercial jobs where it was all about making money. This was a completely different attitude towards things. I mean, you knew you were going into a war, and this was the great thing about war. Everybody dug in and helped everybody else, and that's to some degree why I enjoyed my career during the war, because the camaraderie was terrific all over.
But the supply of air raid shelters was far less than the demand.
The big thing with air raid shelters was the slowness with which they were able to put it up, because before the war started it wasn't too bad, but when men started going in the services, labour became less and less, and the trouble was they couldn't keep up. So, and the main thing was the community shelters were the big thing, because there were more community shelters needed than there were individual shelters, if you follow what I mean, because everybody hadn't got a back garden. In those days it was back-to-back housing, as you know, and there was no way you could put a shelter in that under those conditions.
Did you use the community shelters yourself?
Oh, I have done, not in this town, but I have done in other towns, yes.
How long were you doing this job selling the air raid shelters?
To my best of my knowledge, a year or something of that sort. I joined up in 40, you see, and the war broke out in 39.
So you were doing this job in 39, by the sound of it.
Well, I was, but it was interspersed with another job I did in the engineering department. It wasn't all air raid shelters. It was a job I was given to do with my normal job, you see.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war?
Yes, I did. I was camping on the day we went away for the weekend, and it was a place called Fraythorpe near Bridlington, and we had a radio in our tent, and we heard him declare war the day war broke out. And we then went off to the pub, and goodness knows why, we had a mighty drink up. I don't know what we were expecting, but you see, we'd been on tenterhooks for weeks and wondering what was going to be declared, and this, when it happened, it was a great relief, quite honestly, you know. And the first night in Hull, when we came back, the air raid warning went off, and you just didn't know what the next move was, you know. It was something quite, you know, you didn't know whether you were going to be blitzed out of it or what. As it turned out, nothing ever happened, and there were many nights like that in Hull. You see, Hull was, well, you'll see it on a tape, I'll show you. Hull was never got when I say credit, if you can use that word, they never got, it was always a town in the northeast. They never mentioned all, but it got terribly battered, this place. And even when they weren't going to Bomb Hull, because the River Humber was a great navigational from their point of view, they could pick the River Hull out as they came in, the German bombers, you know, dead easy. And if they were going into the West Riding or Sheffield or somewhere like that, as they came over Hull, you dived in your air raid shelter, although you weren't being bombed. And when they came back again, you were still in your air raid shelter. So they spent many hours in the shelters in Hull when it, for no reason at all. Well, just because they were in the area. They then, of course, had their own blitz, which was pretty horrific at times. I mean, when I used to come home on leave, I felt very, very vulnerable, quite honestly. I mean, there was, you just, I used to spend most of my time in air raid shelters with my parents, you know. I mean, it was going almost continually, night after night after night. And it wasn't very clever, I didn't think.
Do you think public morale was affected in Hull by the bombing?
If anything, it made them more bloody-minded, quite frankly. No, I never even saw, after raids, I never saw people with the heads down at all. And, of course, you must remember that people did lose relatives and friends, things like that, which made it pretty tough on people, you know.
Now, can we go on to your joining the Air Force, please? Can you tell me how it came about?
Yeah, well, I joined the Volunteer Reserves to start with. I volunteered. And I was called up in... when would it be? August 40 it would be. And I joined up and I went to Blackpool for initial training. We did our square bash in there and just generally became acclimatised with the rudiments of the RAF, you know, sort of marching and discipline and this sort of thing. Nothing to do with flying at the time, although the intake was a flying intake. And as I say, for 3 months or so we were down in Blackpool there.
How were you treated by the people in charge?
Well, generally speaking, I think a lot of ex-servicemen concur with this. The regulars who were obviously had the sergeant stripes and the officer stripes, they were the regular, they took us in and they looked at us as though we were a lot of, you know, sort of wet behind the ears, and they really were going to knock us into shape, which they did. They soon put military discipline into us because none of us really knew about these things, you know. And they trained us. They trained us, you know, rifle drill and things of this sort.
Was it done in a reasonable way or in...
Oh, yes. Oh, highly organised. Oh, yes. Most professional. It wasn't a rabble job at all. I mean, every morning. We lived in billets, by the way, in private billets in Blackpool. And every morning you had to be on parade at 7:30 at the top of some street or other for your flight, whichever flight you were in, and you were on parade there at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know. Shaved, changed, had your meal and everything, ready for the day's work.
What were your own personal ambitions as regards the war and the RAF?
Well, I wanted to be a pilot, actually, but whilst I was at Blackpool, we also were taught... to be wireless operators, and we used to go in the tower ballroom there, which was absolutely stacked with hundreds and hundreds of people with earphones on, learning Morse code, you know, because it was Morse in those days. And we learned, that was our first training, real training. And it was to have a pair of ears on your ears all day long and hearing Morse code, it just sent you around the bend, you know. I've seen men get up and run out, just absolutely couldn't take any more, you know. But there were a few, there weren't a lot of those. Is this all right, by the way?
Yes, carry on, please.
Anyway, went there, and then from there onwards, we really began the initial training wing for aircrew started after that. And I, again, was very lucky. I was sent to the Grand Hotel at Scarborough. And this is where you started doing the basics of flying. Not flying, but the theory of flying. i.e. Maps, map reading maps, doing plots, dead reckoning plots, navigation, aircraft recognition, and all the things that you needed to know when you were in aircrew. Gunnery, we did gunnery and things of that sort. And here again, a big thing in was there was a lot of marching and a lot of discipline, which we did on the front at Scarborough, and they turned you out into worthwhile people to become aircrew, really.
And the air raids on Scarborough?
Yes, funny enough, I was on firewatch that night, and there was this German bomber came and strafed the whole of the hotel along the front there, you know. But there was nothing drastic happened from it, but yes, we were shot up there while we were there. There was more going on in the North Sea, actually, you know, with the Navy at the time, you know, at that time, getting convoys through. Because at the time I'm talking about, it would be 40, back in the 40, I mean, food was getting pretty thin, you know. I mean, you've got enough, but just barely enough. You very often had to go out and buy food extra, you know.
So this plane hit the hotel?
No, it just strafed the whole of the promenade and that, you know, with its machine guns and that. It set off a little fire in the hotel, which was of little consequence, but that was the only sort of anything that happened to us while we were there, anyway.
Was this daylight?
No, night time.
What happened next?
Well, we did about 12 weeks training for our initial training wing. We then sent off to a place called West Kirby. That was a camp where you all went. And then we went out onto troop carriers. I went onto HMS Richmond out to South Africa, down to Cape Town then. And this was to start your proper training.
Anything special happened on the way?
Yes. We went from Gourock, a place called Gourock in Scotland. We set out from there, and we set out, and by the way, the complement of this ship was about 3,000 Durham Light Infantry mods from there, and there was about 100 RAF, and we had a pretty rough time with them, because they all thought we were the Brill Cream Boys in those days, you see. But we all got on very well together in the end. But it was really, it was an army troop ship, but we just happened to be on.
What did they do to you, which was unpleasant?
I won't repeat it.
Swearing at you, you know?
Oh, more than that, no. I'll tell you the first incident first, and then I'll take you up on the point you just raised. We got out there and we steamed over. Well, obviously, coming out of Gourock, you steam over the north of Ireland, on the north water of Ireland. And we sat on the deck one day, and one of the bright lads there said, you know, he said, we're going round in circles here. I said, what are you talking about? Well, he said, if you watch the sun, and they'd got this all sorted out of this job, he said, we're not making any headway, you see. And sure enough, for 3 days, the convoy, we were in convoy, by the way, the convoy we were in went round in a circle in north of Ireland. The reason being, there was a pack of German submarines which they knew about out in the North Atlantic picking off ships as they went out, and they were just delaying it. And then we went round, and after the 3 days sort of delaying tactics, we went then down into onto Africa, and our first port of call was Freetown, where they victualled up with water and supplies and things like that. Now, we were shot at in Freetown by the Free French. They had a little bit of their own private war going on down there. They shot us up down there, but it was nothing. We then went right down and we disembarked at Durban, actually. We went into Cape Town, then on to Durban, and we disembarked at Durban. We then went on And we went to Bulawayo, to a camp in Bulawayo.
Before you do that, you're going to tell me about the
conflict with the DLI. Sorry, I'll come back, yeah. What happened? We were in hammocks, by the way. There were no bunks in there. It was a troop ship, and troop ships are pretty rudimentary, believe you me. When I tell you there was a naffy on board, and there used to be a snake of people going all the way down the ship bottom there to just get a cup of tea or something like that. It was tremendous. Anyway, this was when we went into Freetown. They used to they had boys which started selling tropical fruits like pawpaw and paradise fruit and all this, and they used to put a big basket and used to yank it up, you see. Well, obviously, you'd got to eat this stuff immediately because it was in the tropics. But if you took a little supply with you and kept it for a day or two, it became rancid. Well, one night, we're in our bunks, swinging away there, and the door opens, and all these rough Durham Light Infantry lads came in with all this fruit. And what they did, they threw all this gammy fruit up at the ceiling, and we're lying there. And it absolutely stank the place out because it was rancid, was this fruit, you know. Rubbed our faces in it. Oh, we had a terrific time. It was all supposed to be fun, you know. But if you were on the receiving end, it wasn't so clever. But that was that little episode. But what used to happen was this, that we used to have cork life belts. And you used to, and when you're in the tropics there, going over the equator, you used to sit on the deck or sleep on the deck. Sometimes it was that hot. But they had two battalions on this ship of these Durham Light Infantries, and they used to have battles with themselves, and they used to have these cork life belts, and they used to start knocking each other about. And on the higher decks were the captains and officers looking down and thinking, oh, it's just toughening the boys up for what to expect. All right for them, of course. Anyway, I could tell you a lot more stories, but it's not...
Why not?
No, I won't tell you. It's the coming back part I'll tell you about. When I got on a troop ship coming back. What was
the name of this ship going out?
The Duchess of Richmond. Can I just have my book there? Do you mind? I think it's...
this is your logbook we're talking about.
That's right, my logbook. It's the... it's on the back.
So you were just about to tell me about going into Rhodesia to start your training.
That's right. We went to, I think it's on there, on the book there. It was Bulawayo, camp at Bulawayo. And here where you were introduced to flying, proper flying, and we're on Tiger Moths. And I went solo two or three times, but in the end they decided I hadn't got the qualities to be a pilot, you know. They decided against that. So I was put in what they called a dispersal unit and waited for to be put onto another job. And
who was doing this? Was it British people?
Oh, or yes, there were Rhodesian and British people. Actually, coincidentally, the chap who trained me was a flying officer regular who came from Hessel. You could go around the world and he's almost on your own doorstep.
Hessel is near Hull. Yeah.
Well, that's just outside, yeah.
Did you have any contact with the Rhodesians?
Oh, very much so, yeah. They're very, very hospitable towards us. They were more British about the war than what we were, quite frankly. They were real colonial people. I mean, Cecil Rhodes to them was God, or had been God, you know, who found Rhodesia. And they were certainly very, very patriotic. They took us to their hearts very much so. In fact, quite frankly, on our way down, when I was failed as a pilot, we were sent down into the Union, South Africa into the Union, went to Johannesburg. The day we got into Johannesburg, we were taken to a cinema there, to a picture show. And halfway through the picture show, it was stopped and flashed on the screen. We are pleased to announce that we have with us air crew. We'd never flown or done anything. They thought we were God's air crew from the UK. and the lights went up and everybody got up and clapped, goodness knows why, but it seemed so futile because we were only trainees, we hadn't done anything, you know. But that was the euphoria that was that was out there about it. And then from then onwards I went to a place called Utzon. Now you won't know how to spell that, is it?
I can see. Oh, I can see from your logbook.
Yeah, have you got it there?
Outzon.
Yes, Outzon, which is in the Karoo Desert, which is well, I mean, goodness knows why they picked this place. It was the most horrible place on earth. The sun used to come up in the morning like a fireball, and at midday, through the camp, a whirlwind used to go through the camp every day without fear, you know, and all this sand used to come steaming through. There was dogs whipped up in the air, there were dustbins whipped up, and you had to get inside as you get whipped up yourself. But every day that happened, religiously. And however, we flew, and we were in Anson's in those days, and we did how long would it be now? It would be about, in that part of the world, it'd be about 3 months on navigation there. We used to go out into the Indian Ocean doing exercises and things of that nature. And generally they trained us very, very well. There were exceptional people who were out there, in my opinion anyway. Particularly when they trained people who hadn't got the foggiest idea, you know, sort of about the job in hand when it came.
Did you ever come across any South Africans who weren't supportive of the war?
Oh, indeed, yes, in that neck of the woods, very much so. You see, the Boers were very anti-British, as you may know, and there was a certain sectionmen called Voortrekkers. They were called Voortrekkers, and they had big ostrich farms where we were. This is where the ostrich countries, where the ostriches were, you know. And they were very anti us indeed. I mean, if you went into a bar there on your own, you'd get beaten up, you know, so you always moved around in groups. They were very anti indeed, yes. Only that section of the people, they were basically farmers, the Boer farmers, you know, because they thought that the Boer War took all their rights away when they took the land, etc., etc., from them. They still lived in that world.
Did anybody get beaten up in
Oh,
practice?
yes.
Who was that?
Well, not in my section, but when you went there, you see, you had a talk about certain things, and one was never mixed with these Voortrekker people. They used to drink a drink which was called Viblets, and this was a very strong drink made of grapes. This was their normal drink. They could drink it, and they said, don't drink it, it's fire water, and you know, one drink of that and you'll fall flat on your face, which was proved later on, of course. And they used to fight with bicycle chains. This was their favourite weapon, a bicycle chain, just to whip it round your neck. Oh, they were terrible things happened. No.
Did you see it happen?
I never saw it happen, but you'd go in there, and very often in the back pockets you'd see a chain rolled up in the back pocket, you know. But as I say, if you went in numbers, you were all right. But if you went in on your own, you'd get beaten up. It was that was their attitude. They were pro-Nazi.